You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Okay, so I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I have. You ever spent some time with somebody, maybe had a significant number of conversations with someone, but just felt like they don't know you? And there could be a lot of reasons. Maybe they're just not a good listener, or they kind of live in their own head, or they just aren't very curious about you. But there are times when we're with people and we just don't really feel known or understood. And I wonder if Jesus feels that way about us. I think a lot of people in our culture have kind of a general positivity toward Jesus. I think there's a lot of that out there. You know, Carrie Underwood lets Jesus take the wheel, and people are wearing their Jesus jewelry, and there's, you know, a lot of folks across our whole culture are into that series, The Chosen. I think there's a lot of kind of mild approval, I would say, something like that, of the person of Jesus. And I just wonder, when you think about that, even as we're walking in here, maybe we followed him for a long time, is the Jesus in our minds consistent with the Jesus that really walked the earth? What about that? Can we assume that the kind of our pop culture echo chamber Jesus is the Jesus of history? I know we're going to be going to Mark as our authority, and there's a reason for that. All of the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they lived while Jesus was alive. They valued and sought out first-person eyewitness testimony. We know from sources outside of the New Testament that what's written in our gospels is consistent with historical sources in the first century that are outside the Bible. And so in Mark, we have someone who is way, way, way more close to the events than we are. Somebody who is able to give us an accurate picture of the Jesus that is. And so we're going to be doing kind of a skim through here. And I just want to throw this out. And this is kind of generally why I would really make a pitch for reading this gospel on your own. We can live and continue to live with of your own. Man, we can stay with a Jesus. You can tell I was up a little bit late last night. Of your own making. Or we can pursue this question. How well is the Jesus in my mind matching up with who Jesus wants us to know he is? Okay, so that's what we're going to do, kind of high altitude. We're going to take you through a ton of different stuff just so you can start to see the drumbeat, this kind of breathless pace that Mark has and what he's trying to teach us about Jesus. Okay. Picking up in chapter 1 again, after John had been taken into custody, Jesus came into Galilee preaching the gospel of God and saying, "The time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel." Okay, so right here we're confronted with Jesus' main mission, what he mainly came to do, which was to preach the gospel of God. The gospel, which we talked about last week, being a word often associated with the Roman emperors, it just meant good tidings, good news. And this gospel is associated with Jesus himself and what he came to offer, and it was the focal point of his ministry. Now, it mentions he came into Galilee. If you look, it's a very faded map of Israel, but in the north, there is a teeny body of water called the Sea. It's really the lake of Galilee. And if you zoom in on that, you can see up in the northwest corner, there was a little town, which is still, you can visit it today, called Capernaum. And this is the site of a lot of what we're about to read. Jesus is in this little seaside fishing village, carrying out this mission to preach the gospel. Now it says, they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he enters the synagogue. And what does he do? First thing, he teaches. Once again, this is his main mission. What Mark wants us to focus on here, though, is the crowd's response. They were amazed, it says, at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as the scribes. You know, back in this culture, it was really common for rabbis that would come into synagogues, teachers, to cite earlier well-known rabbis for their from their tradition to support their points. Kind of the way I would get up here and quote Christian authors. A lot of folks would not appeal to their own authority. They would cite earlier authorities. But Jesus was different. Jesus cited himself. And if you read through the Gospels, you'll hear a lot of, you may have heard people say, but I say to you. And it is all over the place. Just in Matthew, he uses this phrase, I say to you, that many times. I could fill the screen with references where he's saying this. And it's clear he was different. He was speaking as if his own words and the sheer fact that he spoke them was enough to just accept as an authority. That he himself and what he said was the only authority that he needed to appeal to. And you can imagine if I was talking like that, you'd be sitting here like, I don't know what to think about this. And that's how they felt. But before they could think about it very long, it says, just then there was a man in their synagogue with an unclean spirit. So he just disrupts everything. And he cries out saying, what business do we have with each other, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. Okay, so whoa, a lot to talk about here. An unclean spirit, according to the Bible, is a demon. A demon is a fallen angel who's rebelled against God and allied itself with Satan. We're going to encounter demons all the way through the Gospel of Mark. And this one, it's crazy. The one being in the room who recognizes the significance of Jesus being there is this demon. He gets it, okay? And in some kind of creepy voice, this demon has taken over this poor man, and he's like, Jesus, you've come to destroy us. Which is, that would just be like a horror movie scene, right? Just like, oh my God, I can't believe this is going on. What's crazy, though, is if you're looking for like horror movie thrills, you don't get it. Okay, there's no like blood oozing through the walls. Nobody's head rotates 360 degrees. That's not how this turns out. It says that Jesus rebuked him and said, be quiet and come out of him. And throwing him into convulsions, the unclean spirit came out with a loud voice and came out. So, yeah, there was no holy water, some bug-eyed clergyman struggling with the demon. Jesus is just like, shut up, get out. Movie's over, roll the credits. There's nothing else to say. You thought it was going to be incredible, but no, that's all there is. And you know, what's weird is when you look at contemporary, we have other first century extra-biblical exorcism accounts, and they're way more elaborate. There's like rituals, and there's an appeal to a higher authority, and special postures and procedures, just so many bells and whistles. None of that here. What do we have? Just Jesus and the authority of his words. Okay, so he didn't just walk up and teach with authority. He walked in the place like it was his living room, just started acting like he was in charge, and when a demon shows up, he's like, we're done with you. Obviously, if we were in a setting like this, you know, people are watching all this unfold, we would be amazed like they were. It says they were amazed and they were debating among themselves, saying, what is this? A new teaching with authority, and he's commanding these unclean spirits and they obey him. You know, and in Greek, this isn't like a ooh, ah, like you'd be watching fireworks and you're appreciating how amazing they are. If you read the vibe of this in Greek, it's something closer to alarm. Like they don't have an analogy in their life for someone that's this authoritative. And I can relate. I've been in a situation like this. When I was in sixth grade, we used to have show and tell in class. I don't know if that's a thing in school anymore, but back then, we actually did this. You could like bring in your dog or bring in your ant farm, and we would take a chunk of time in our class and we'd hear about the thing you want to tell us about. Well, one time, and this is a true story, I'm not making this up. A kid brought in the owner of a gun shop who brought along with him about a dozen different weapons. Okay? Pistols, rifles, assault rifles, machine guns, spread out on the teacher's desk. He's holding this machine gun with this faraway look in his eyes, like, I like to shoot beer cans and just kind of watch them dance and explode. And I'm sitting there, we're all sitting there like, this is the coolest show and tell ever. And we're like, I'm a little bit terrified. You know, there's a guy with a machine gun in my classroom. So it was kind of like that, like, wow, he says what he wants. He bosses demons around. He tells us the way it is. And it seems like he's got what it takes to back it up. It was that astonishing. What is this, right? I just can't believe it. Well, immediately, obviously, the word gets out about that, right? Everywhere, to the surrounding district of Galilee. And again, remember how I've been saying Mark's breathless? Immediately, after they came out of the synagogue, so same day, they came into the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Okay, so whole new scene. He goes back to the place where he has a lot of friends. Turns out Peter's mother-in-law has a fever. And again, you know, Mark's language is so sparse. If he was married, it had to drive his wife nuts. Honey, how was your day? Fine. Right? That's just the kind of guy he was. In this case, she has a fever. Jesus comes in, came to her, raises her up, takes her by the hand, and the fever's gone. Doesn't even say anything. He's like, come on, let's get up. Wow. He commands with teaching authority. He tells demons what to do, and he sends a fever packing. What are we supposed to get from this? He has authority, not just to teach, not just over the spiritual realm, but over the physical realm as well. So all this happened in one day. Long day, hard work for Jesus. He's coming home, he's tired, hoping he can relax. It says, when evening came after the sun had set, they began bringing to him all who were ill and those who were demon-possessed, and the whole city, it's about 2,000 people back then, was gathered at the door. Imagine, you know, you're walking home and you just see this glow in the distance and just people milling around in your front yard. And they're there to be healed. You know, back then there was not like a minute clinic in a nearby strip mall. A runaway fever or, you know, an unset bone. I mean, you were one small injury away from a serious medical problem at any time in the ancient world. There's real desperation in this crowd. And Jesus responds. He heals many who are ill with various diseases, and he casts out demons, and he wasn't permitting the demons to speak because they knew who he was. Now, one thing I just want to say quickly as an aside, because somebody here is probably thinking this. Some people accuse or charge the gospel writers as being too ignorant to know the difference between a sickness and demon possession, okay? But if you read this gospel and the other gospels closely, that's not the case. Even here, he clearly understands there's a difference between illness from various diseases and something like demon possession. If you read further in this gospel, there's a very crystal clear passage where Mark obviously understands that there's a distinction. And so, no, it's not like every sickness was connected to a demon, but the main thing we're supposed to get from this, in the fact that he was both healing physical maladies and addressing spiritual powers, is that he has authority over both. That's what we're supposed to pick up from this. And there's one more thing in this episode that we're supposed to pick up, and it's kind of a hard thing. It says, he eventually got some sleep, apparently. In the early morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, he left the house, and he went away to a secluded place, and he was praying there. Simon and his companions searched for him. They found him and said, "Everyone is looking for you." And there is a tone of exasperation here. You know, you've got a yard full of sick people, a city full of need. What are you doing up here? There are people that need you present with them. And I don't know if you've ever felt that way, where you've, you know Jesus, you know he's powerful, and you know someone who's very sick and needs his help, and you're wondering, well, where is he? Why isn't he here? And Jesus gave this answer, and this is not an easy answer to hear, but this is what he says. He says, "We must go on to other towns as well, and I will preach to them too. That's why I came." That statement, that's the mission, right? This is sprinkled all the way through here. The mission is to get the word out, to get this gospel good news out. And hear what we see. He's clearly saying, this is my higher priority. I can walk away with my eyes wide open, knowing that there are more people to heal, and I can do that because this other thing, this greater thing, is a more pressing issue. You guys know Johnny Erickson Tata, right? I think it was in 1967 in the summer. She was diving in the Chesapeake Bay, and she misjudged the depth of the water, and she was paralyzed from the shoulders down. She's still paralyzed. She's prayed her whole life that she could get better. And she talks about this a lot, and she cites this passage. When if you've ever heard her speak, she's a great speaker, but she'll often talk about Mark 1, verse 38, where Jesus, knowing there are sick people nearby, goes on to the next town. And just to summarize, her take on this, and she's right, is that one thing we're hearing is that the most pressing problem is not our vulnerability to physical illnesses, it is a spiritual problem. And this is really integral to the gospel. The gospel's diagnosis, this is part of this message, is that our most pressing dilemma is our sin, the things that we do that alienate ourselves from each other, from God, ways that we hurt people, that we actually are walking around morally culpable before God because of the way we live, that we actually stand the possibility of spending eternity apart from God because of this spiritual dilemma that we have, and that this, and not our physical state, as heartbreaking as it can be sometimes, but this fact, the spiritual reality of our brokenness and sinfulness, is the most pressing problem. And Jesus departed so that he could get the word out about that to as many people as possible. So the crowds want a healer. And understandably, I do too. We all want a healer, and there's nothing wrong with that. But Jesus was more than that. He was more than just a healer.
Any
view of Jesus that stops at "I want a healer" is not enough. He was a guy who focused on the gospel. And just so you have this in your head, the heart of the gospel, this message Jesus came to bring, is that forgiveness for that weight of sin that we all feel is available. If we simply, what Jesus called it, he called it repenting, just changing our mind, agreeing with God's diagnosis that we've got a moral issue with him, and appealing to him for mercy and forgiveness through Christ. That's the gospel. That's what Jesus spent his entire ministry trying to prioritize. And so I just would ask, as we're checking our Jesus against the Jesus we find in Mark, does your Jesus have that priority? Is your Jesus calling out to you to deal with that moral dilemma? Right after this, and I'm glad it's here, Jesus runs into a leper, which was a heartbreaking, chronic, debilitating, disfiguring condition. We can cure it easily. They couldn't back then. He sees this guy and moved with compassion. His impulse, right? That's the wording here, was to stretch out his hand and touch him and say, "I'm willing, be cleansed." And so the leprosy left the guy. Yeah, this might have been the first time in decades this individual felt the touch of a human being, the compassionate touch of someone else. And so does Jesus care? Yes, he cares. Where he had the opportunity, he healed every chance he got. But this larger mission was much more pressing. So let's just catch our breath here for a second. How's your Jesus doing compared to what we see in Mark? Is your Jesus compassionate? I think a lot of us are really drawn to that. We really love the fact that Jesus, more than anyone in any ancient book that you could ever read about, Jesus loved people, especially the ones who were despised. And we celebrate that, and you're right to celebrate that. But this Jesus also had a mission, and he insisted that our most pressing needs are spiritual. That our most pressing need is a moral dilemma, that we need forgiveness from God. What about your Jesus? And this idea that he is an authority, that he teaches with authority, that he tells things and people what to do, he can send a fever packing, that he has that level of power. When you're thinking about your Jesus, just kind of walking around, does the word authority come to mind? Authoritative? Commander? I wonder. That's the Jesus that we're being presented with here so far. Now, the word that Jesus is an authority was getting out to one group of people. A group of people called the scribes and Pharisees. This is the religious establishment. The scribes who are responsible for kind of holding on to the collection of documents, and then the Pharisees who had this incredible zeal to keep the law of God. They get wind that Jesus is teaching with this kind of authority. They don't like it, and they show up to oppose it. And we come into a scene in chapter 2 where Jesus goes back, he's in the house where he's staying, and the whole place is packed, standing room only, people spilling into the front door, and this desperate group of four men, they come in and clear a hole in the ceiling like it's shown here and lower their buddy down who's paralyzed, hoping that he'll be healed. Now, what was Jesus there to do? It says right at the beginning, he was there to speak the word. He was carrying out his mission. But then there's this kind of, you know, imagine, like, I'm a little bit interrupted here by this guy coming down. It says Jesus just looked at the effort it took. He saw their faith, and he says to the paralytic, "Son, your sins are forgiven." Okay, so he's got these religious authorities who want to confront him, and Jesus is ready. Instead of healing the guy like he did in all these other cases, he's like, hold tight, I'll get to you in a second. Hey, everybody, I just forgive this guy's sins. That's insane. That's crazy. Now, we've got Leslie and Tom right here. Okay, a lovely couple. And everything I'm about to say is completely hypothetical, okay? I'm sorry, you two, but I know you will. I can do this. So let's say I look over and I can tell Tom is cussing out Leslie. And I'm like, I can't believe it. He's such a sweethearted man. And so I walked up to Tom. I'm like, Tom, I hope you never talk to Leslie like that again, but I just want you to know, I forgive you. I forgive you, Tom? Like, I can do that? That would be so preposterous. What would I be implying if I just cruised in? I'm not part of that moment. That's not anything I have anything to do with. For me to just walk in and forgive him, that's crazy talk, right? To say that is so outrageous, and it's on purpose. Jesus is picking a fight. Of course, the authorities are like, I can't believe this guy speaks this way. They're not naive. They get the implications. He's blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone? Now, Jesus knows what they're thinking, and instead of saying, no, wait a minute, don't get carried away. He doesn't do that. He doubles down, pushes what he's saying even further, and he sets up a little test. He's like, let's do this. What's easier to say to the paralytic? Your sins are forgiven, or to say, get up, pick up your pallet, and walk? And so, by saying this, he really has these guys on the horns of a dilemma, because the religious establishment wrongly believed that this guy was paralyzed because of his sin. And so working with their wrong assumptions, Jesus is like, well, if you think paralysis is due to sin, then what is a healing? It must be forgiveness. And so he says, so that you might know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he tells the guy, get up, take your pallet, get out of here. And that's exactly what happens. He gets up immediately, picks up his pallet, walks out of the room in the sight of everybody so that they're all amazed. They're glorifying God, saying, we've never seen anything like this. Okay, so now we're taking it up just a little bit higher. Not just casting out demons, not just healing a fever, saying he can forgive sin and proving it. I mean, all these religious leaders, they're like, technical foul, no way, you can't do that. You are claiming to be God. And Jesus is like, dude, get up, walk, boom, done, heal, demonstrated. He doesn't back down from that at all. Yeah, and so he's using what they can see to confirm what they can't, and that's a thing. But the bigger thing is he's pushing the envelope. Trying to, you know, you've got him in a healer box, you've got him in this good teacher box, this moral example box. Mark's like, the box is a little bit bigger. He's asserting here, Jesus is asserting, I'm more than all of that. Not just compassionate, I'm God. That's what we're confronted with. Now, the next scenario, there's a party. Matthew, the tax collector, is hosting a party. A lot of immoral people there. Mark calls them tax gatherers and sinners. And again, it seems like, I don't know, maybe they had binoculars, but these religious leaders are observing everything Jesus does. And they're upset. They're like, I can't believe a so-called good teacher would hang out with such bad people. And Jesus is like, look, they're sick and I'm the doctor. The doctor's in the house. Not physically sick, they've got this moral issue, this spiritual problem, and Jesus is like, I'm here. You think you're righteous, I can't help you, but they get the fact that they're not, and I am just the cure for them. Oh man, again, that's just such a strong way to talk about himself. Again, it says they came to him and said, why did John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples don't fast?
Apparently, and we know this from record, Jewish records actually, in the first century, the Pharisees would fast twice a week, like on Mondays and Thursdays. And they were really, really upset that Jesus and his disciples didn't follow these traditions. And you'd think Jesus could, like, okay, let's just get our Bibles open. What is the only day of the year where fasting's commanded in the Old Testament? Well, if you read your Old Testament law, it is only commanded once a year on the Day of Atonement. And so Jesus could have been like, you know, your emphasis here is kind of misplaced. You should read your Bibles more. But Jesus doesn't do that. Jesus just calmly says, the wedding guests can't fast while the groom is with them. Can they? As long as they have the groom with them, that's Jesus, they can't fast. It would be inappropriate for them to fast. I'm here. The only thing is, to their ear, who is the groom? You know, I was part of a wedding party. And the groom was delighted to get married. And we drank some bourbon and prayed and told him we loved it. It was such a sweet time. It was not a time for fasting. Jesus is right. But in this analogy, when this audience hears the groom, who are they thinking about? They're thinking about in the Old Testament how God, you know, Almighty Yahweh is Israel's husband. That the people of God are married. You read in Isaiah, in Jeremiah, in Ezekiel, in Hosea, the groom is Yahweh, the God of Israel. I'm here. Why would they fast? Whoa. That is insanely, just over the top, but an incredible thing to say. It says, it happened that he was passing through the grain fields on the Sabbath. It's another episode. And his disciples began to make their way along while picking grains of heads of grain. The Pharisees were saying to him, look, why are they doing what's not lawful on the Sabbath? You know, back then you couldn't pull into a Taco Bell when you were hungry if you were away from your house to get a bite to eat. That's not how it worked. You had to be really creative to deal with hunger. And so Jesus' disciples, on the Sabbath, which is supposed to be a day of rest, are walking through the grain fields and grabbing a couple heads of grain and munching on the kernels just to take the edge off their hunger. Okay, and the Pharisees see this, and again, they're like, penalty. You were not allowed to do that. Working, harvesting, breaking Sabbath law. I cannot believe how brazen Jesus and his disciples are about doing this. Now, in this case, Jesus takes them to an Old Testament story. He takes them to a scenario where people are hungry and God allows them to eat some bread that's normally devoted for use in the temple. It's a law break of some sort, but because God's merciful and because it was a pressing need, The higher thing is that God's loving and wants to care for his people, and he allows them to eat this bread. And so he lays that out, and he very effective, but he, again, he doesn't leave it there. After making his case that they were kind of narrow and heartless, and they were missing the whole spirit of the Old Testament law, he says, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. He's like, you're missing the whole tenor of things. And then he says, oh, and by the way, the Son of Man, that's me. That's his favorite nickname for himself. Jesus is saying, the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath. You know that special day, that day of rest? That's my day. And I decide what goes and doesn't go on that day. Can you see what Jesus is doing? We've got him in this little cubby hole, and people have all the things they want to get out of Jesus and all the ways they want to see Jesus. And he's like, no, that's not how it's going to be. I am not who you think I am. And just to kind of underscore this, that the next opportunity on a Sabbath, a guy shows up in a synagogue with a withered hand, and the people in the synagogue were super critical. They were like, is he going to do it? Is he going to break the Sabbath and heal this guy? And Jesus knows that they're thinking this, and it says that he said to the man with the withered hand in this scenario, get up and come forward. And he said to them, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save a life or to kill? Man, that's a great question. You're sitting here looking at a guy who can't use his extremity, and you're concerned that it's a Sabbath day? This guy's suffered this way for decades, and all you can do is sit there and make him want to wait another day? And Jesus, what a pointed question. Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? What are we talking about? Your scrupulous observance to all of your laws and all of the pursuit of that, you've lost the heart of God. That's why they sit there in silence. They're just like, there's no way to answer that question. And then it says, after looking around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. He's like, I do not operate like that. I am not like you. I am not a God of heartless, rule-based, rote obedience. I am a God of mercy and grace, and this man will be healed today, right now. And so, some people in this crowd teared up, I'm sure. And you can read in verse 8 of this chapter that people from all over Israel, the whole area, started coming to him for Jesus' message of hope. But the Pharisees and the scribes, they just kind of narrowed their eyes and got more and more angry. And it says that they went out and immediately began conspiring with the Herodians against Jesus as how they might destroy him, okay? And so it begins. We get this little hint of where this conflict with the religious leaders is going to head. All right, so what can we learn from this? A couple things to reflect on. I think we really do need to think, as we've kind of toured through this passage, who is the Jesus in your mind? In your conception of Jesus, who is he? Does he care about not just the physical and emotional pain, but, you know, anything in your life that's a hardship or a challenge? Is he like that? The answer in this book is absolutely. He absolutely, deeply, deeply cares about you and whatever you might be going through. Does your Jesus insist that your most pressing need is for forgiveness? Is the Jesus that you're thinking about someone who's calling on you, letting you know, you can't come to me claiming to be righteous. I can't heal someone like that. But if you own your sin and call out for forgiveness, I'll come to you. Do you sense the Jesus in your mind calling you to that? Because that's what the real Jesus is doing. He wants you to know a relationship with him is possible just by turning to him, just by responding to that gospel message. I wonder, too, because it's so widely held out there, can you see that mild approval of Jesus is not an option? You know, we saw he was an authoritative teacher. He commanded spirits and fevers, and he was the Lord of the Sabbath. He was the authority. He is God. Doesn't really leave a lot of room for mild approval. Not the Jesus of the book of Mark. Here's C.S. Lewis. He's reflecting on all these claims that Jesus makes. He says, on the one side, you've got this clear, definite teaching. On the other, claims which, if not true, are those of a megalomaniac. He's like, you got to pick your side here. The idea of a great moral teacher saying what Christ said is out of the question. The only person who can say that sort of thing is either God or a complete lunatic. He says, we can note in passing, and he's right, read the Gospels and see what you think, but he says, we can note in passing that Jesus was never regarded as mere moral, as a mere moral teacher. He didn't produce that effect on any of the people who actually met him. That's not how people react to Jesus in the Gospels. He produced mainly three effects: hatred, terror, or adoration. And there was no trace of people expressing mild approval. If we were in the room with him, we would feel compelled toward one of these three, but not mild approval. And so, yeah, what about that? What about that version of Jesus? I know some folks would say, well, even if he's good, I just hate authority. I just can't stand living under somebody's thumb. Well, let me ask you, is really authority always bad? Aren't there some situations where authority is pretty good? Now, I used to play tackle football. I may not look like it. But when I was a little kid, I played tackle football in my neighborhood. And we played all the time. And one of the things that was a real drag about our sandlot football or whatever is we were always arguing. We spent half the time arguing over questionable calls. Like, that wasn't a catch, you were out of bounds, you blocked me in the back, just like yelling and screaming, and gameplay is disrupted till like finally we start again. And it just wore us down. And I remember one time we're playing football, and I don't know if it's because this dude was sick of hearing us fight all the time, but this guy walks out in full referee regalia. He's got the shirt with the stripes. He's got the whistle. He's got the flags. I mean, he's ready to rock and be our official. And he comes up to us. He's like, look, I think you guys could use a referee. And I'll do that on one condition. You have to submit to every call I make without any moaning. And we kind of looked at each other, and we're like, oh, okay, it's got to be better than what we're doing. And so he was the official, and that was one of the funnest football games we ever had. We had this impartial judge who made it possible to really enjoy playing. It felt like you were on TV. Oh, I got called for a block. That's so cool. I'll never play high school football. I'll never have a chance. I'm too small. This is my one opportunity. It was great. And it's not that authority is bad. Authority, man, think about this. Think about the need for authority when things go wrong, when a crime has been committed, when the culture's starting to get ripped apart, when lawlessness rules. People are like, I want an authority. I want somebody to come in here and establish justice, right? It doesn't have to be a bad thing if the authority is good. And Jesus is that kind of good authority, right? He's a king, but not the kind of king who forces you to follow him. He wants you to serve him, but in serving him, he'll set you free. I promise you, if you reach out to Jesus and ask him to be your authority, you'll never regret it. He's so good. He's so committed to our well-being. He wants to lead us into an abundant life. Ask somebody that's been following Christ for a while and they'll tell you, meeting him and coming under his leadership is the best thing that ever happened to him. Yeah, God, thanks for these prayers. And just help us as we're going through the day today just to remember who you really are. And I agree with that one brother that said, you know what you need to give us, what we need more than anything, and you went to great lengths to give us the forgiveness that we all need, and I just thank you for that, God. Amen.